By all accounts, 29-year-old Grant Amato had an obsession.
All right, Sylvia, look at me. I'm outside going to check the mail. And I'm asking you if you can please, pretty please, send me one of your videos. I love it so much when you just send them to me. Yeah, I don't like buying your stuff. It makes me feel weird. Could you please send me one, though?
That obsession was an online cam model from Bulgaria, a woman named Sylvie.
Grant Amato was and is obsessed with this woman. Sylvie is an internet cam model. I put quotation marks around the word model, working from Bulgaria.
He had never met Sylvie, only chatted with her online and sent her money. Lots of money that wasn't always his, but his parents and brothers.
The defendant, Grant Amato, became addicted to her, consumed with her, possessed by her, to the point that he was spending hundreds of thousands of dollars of the family's money on her. Hundreds of thousands of dollars to, quote, be with her on her internet website.
In fact, Grant's obsession with Sylvie was a point of contention within his family.
And he presented to her a persona that was not who he really was. A professional gamer, owned his own home, drove a BMW. That's what the persona was that he presented himself to her.
On December 28th, 2018, Grant was checked into a rehabilitation facility for treatment for sex addiction and depression after his parents and two older brothers had staged an intervention with him less than a month earlier. Grant didn't stay at the facility for the full 60-day treatment. He checked himself out more than a month early on January 9th, 2019. And before long, he was talking to Sylvie again. And according to Grant, there was again friction in the family when his father found out. The following is what Grant says happened on Thursday, January 24th, 2019. Grant woke up around 7:30 or 8 o'clock in the morning, and throughout the day, he was at home with his mom, Margaret. She was working from home while he prepped for a job interview he had the next day. At 29, Grant still lived at home with his parents, as well as his older brother, Cody, who was 31. Both his dad, Chad, and Cody left to go to their respective jobs that day. Chad was a retail pharmacist at CVS, and Cody, a registered nurse anesthetist. Around 4 p.m., Grant was on the couch watching YouTube videos when he saw his mom put some chicken out on the counter and pour herself a glass of wine. She then took it back into her office. Chad came home a little later and first went into Margaret's office. He then came into the living room and sat down on the couch. According to Grant, Chad accused him of having contact with Sylvie, even though it was against the house rules that had just been put forth by his father. Chad asked Grant why he was still contacting her, and the conversation got heated. At one point, Chad physically grabbed Grant by his jacket and told him he had to pack up his things and leave the house. Grant grabbed a duffel bag, clothes, gloves, and some toiletries. It was January 24th, and so the temperature was a little cold for Florida standards. As Grant was packing, Chad came upstairs and they continued to argue. They then went into the master bedroom so Chad could get Grant's passport and car keys from the safe. Grant would later say that Chad remarked that he would have to reset the safe passcode because Grant had been in the room while the safe had been opened. Chad then went into his closet and retrieved Grant's cell phone, laptop, banking paperwork, credit cards, and car insurance info. Grant took the items and put them into his duffel bag while Chad went downstairs to talk to Margaret. Grant then went into his brother Cody's room to retrieve some flash drives so he could reinstall programs to his laptop. Grant loaded his belongings into his car, including his suit for his interview the next morning. He then spoke to Chad in the driveway for about an hour and a half before heading back to the house to collect more of his things. Chad gave him a credit card for a one-night stay at a hotel. His brother Cody then came home, went into Grant's room, and gave him his debit card and told him to use it for anything Grant needed to take care of himself while Cody tried to smooth things over. Cody then walked him out. Grant said goodbye to his mom and went to his car. It was between 12 and 12:30 a.m. when he pulled away from his house for the last time. According to Grant, he then went to the local Publix parking lot to use their Wi-Fi so he could get the address for his interview. He fell asleep in his car and then headed to his interview around 6:45 the next morning. The chain of events that I just told you is what Grant's defense attorney would tell a jury 6 months later when Grant found himself seated behind a defense table. Something terrible had happened to Grant's family that night, and prosecutors allege that he was the one responsible.
And when his parents found out about his, quote, relationship with Sylvie and the tremendous amounts of money that it was spending on her, they contacted her and they let her know the lies that he was telling her and who he really was. And that effectively ended his relationship with Sylvie.
This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 114. Washing our hands is always one of the most important things we can do, but washing them frequently really dries out my hands, a feeling that I absolutely cannot stand. So I started using Caldrea. Caldrea is a consciously crafted home and body care brand that combines thoughtful ingredients with delectable scents, making caring for ourselves and our homes a better experience. They have this great line of hand care products that includes both hand soaps and moisturizing lotions that are incredibly effective, thoughtfully formulated, and smell divine. Available in indulgent scents like ginger pomelo and basil blue sage, they make you want to wash your hands again and again. The ginger pomelo has a citrusy ginger, basil, and sweet peony smell, which my husband even likes. Now you can get free shipping on orders of $50 or more when you buy online at Caldrea.com. That's Caldrea.com. Visit Caldrea.com and add wonder to your washing. What if I told you that you could color your hair in the comfort of your own home for a really great price, and that you'd also get the tools you need to choose your perfect color? Well, now you can do just that with Madison Reed. Gone are the days when you only had two options for coloring your hair: outdated at-home color or the time and expense of a traditional salon. With Madison Reed, you can take coloring your hair at home to the next level and get beautiful, professional hair color delivered right to your door, starting at just $22. What makes Madison Reed's color unique is that it's crafted by master colorists who blend nuances of light, dark, cool, and warm tones to create over 55 gorgeous multidimensional shades. And don't worry, finding the perfect shade couldn't be easier. You just go to their website, madison-reed.com, and take their quiz that'll ask you things like what you want your end result to be and what your hair texture is. Then they match you with your perfect shade. So now you can do your hair coloring at home and look as if you just came from the salon. And now Court Junkies can get 10% off plus free shipping on their first color kit with the code COURT. Go to madison-reed.com and use the code COURT. That's madison-reed.com and use the code COURT. Chris Sisko was concerned. It was after 7 a.m. on January 25th, 2019, and his friend and coworker, Cody Amato, hadn't come into work yet. Cody was someone who always arrived early, even before Chris, so it was very unusual and not like him. He sent Cody a text message, "Hey, where are you?" And he immediately noticed that the message bubble was green and not blue as it usually was. He took that to mean the text wasn't going through. He tried calling Cody's phone, but after ringing a couple times, it went right to voicemail. Chris wasn't the only one who thought it was weird. After talking to some of his colleagues, they decided to call the police department and request a wellness check. Deputy Todd Motorson with the Seminole County Sheriff's Office responded to the Amato home on Sultan Circle in Chuliota, Florida. He knocked on the doors and pounded on the windows, calling out Cody's name. Nothing. He walked around the house and nothing looked amiss. There were no signs of a break-in or a forced entry. He contacted his supervisor, who told him that he could enter the home as long as he didn't create any damage. So he and another deputy, Deputy Montre, used a knife to move aside a deadbolt on one of the doors. They then walked through the house, looking for Cody or for signs of anything odd.
Sheriff's Office! Police! Police!
They came across Cody's body first. He was lying on his side in a fetal position at the threshold of the door that connects the house to the garage. Deputy Motorson thought it looked like a Signal 32, meaning a self-inflicted gunshot wound, and he radioed to dispatch as such. But then he corrected himself and realized that he didn't know what he was looking at. Signal 7, he told the dispatcher, which is code for a possible dead person. The deputies then discovered Chad's body, lying on his back, face up, in the kitchen. They continued searching the house. Another one down, Deputy Montre said. Margaret was sitting in a chair in her home office, slumped over at her desk in front of a computer. Her face was down on her keyboard. She's been shot in the face, one of them reported. 59-year-old Chad Amato, 61-year-old Margaret Amato, and 31-year-old Cody Amato had all died from gunshot wounds. 2 days after the bodies were found, Grant Amato, who had been located by police at a hotel in Orange County, was sitting in an interview room with detectives. He was calmly telling them how his father was an angry and violent type person.
Overbearing. He would like push my mom, and like one instance, you know, it was getting to that age where me and Cody were kind of getting old enough to maybe be able to do something if she needed our help. And I remember her and my dad were like in their room, which if you go down the stairs, it's right there to the left. We heard our mom yell that he's hurting me. And then me and Cody run downstairs and we go into the room. And then we're trying to get our dad off of our mom, and then my dad elbows back, and that's why my nose has got its little, like, bridge right there. But, I mean, that's, like, how he was, like, spankings with a 2x4, you know, like, baseball practice. It'd be, like, 4 or 5 hours, and he's hurling the ball as fast as an adult can, and we're, like, 7th to 8th grade trying to catch this stuff. Yeah, I mean, definitely very overbearing, but he would always rationalize that he's just trying to, like, secure our future.
Violent towards the family?
Violent towards my mom and towards me. Never to and towards Jason, but never to Cody.
He said his dad made him feel like Cody was the favorite and would tell him that Cody was doing this or that, making him feel like he should be doing it too. He said his dad was the one who forced him to go into rehab at a place called Cornerstone, after he spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on Sylvie, money that not only came from him, he admitted, but from his father and brother.
He would, like, allow me to spend money that he had, like, with his credit card or something like that. But it's like, then whenever I did, it was, like, a huge problem.
Okay, so you had one of his credit cards.
Yeah.
And what were you buying with it?
Well, what I was doing is over the past 4 months or something like that, I've been talking to this woman online.
Who's she?
She's as embarrassing as it is. She's a cam model.
A what?
A cam model. Do either of you guys know that?
Nope. Just like all the videos, you have to tell us.
A cam model. It's like they. It's like a virtual girlfriend, I guess you could say.
Okay.
Like that type of situation.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the money went to her.
Okay. Where's she at?
She lives in Bulgaria.
Where?
Bulgaria.
Where's that?
Over in Europe. It's like outside of Germany.
Okay.
Something like that.
You ever been there?
No.
Okay.
It wasn't that serious.
So okay. What would you give her money for?
Just for like the time online with her.
Okay.
Yeah. So it was just like that type of thing.
And what did she charge? By the minute? By the hour?
Minute.
Okay.
Yeah.
Grant said that in June of 2018, he was arrested and accused of grand theft in the third degree. He, like his brother Cody, was a nurse anesthetist, and he was dismissed from his job after they accused him of stealing propofol. He said the investigation went on for 6 months, and during that time, he wasn't allowed to work. Finally, in December, he said his charges were dropped due to no evidence. For the first 2 weeks in December, he said he, Cody, and another friend went to Japan on vacation. He said while they were gone, his mom and dad were dealing with a lot of financial stuff, namely the fact that Grant had spent over $200,000 of their money on Sylvie. When he and his friends got back from their trip, he said his dad started to become overbearing. Every single day, he said his dad would come home from work and would want to have a talk with him. He said his dad would get heated during those talks, but that he would always remain calm because he knew he was in the wrong. Spending $200,000 of the family's money, after all, was idiotic, he said. When asked when the last time he and his dad had a heated conversation, he said Thursday, meaning 2 days prior, and proceeded to tell them how he had been kicked out.
One of his rules was that I wasn't allowed to talk to the woman anymore that I had been talking to. But I guess you could say behind the scenes, my mom would let me talk to her through her cell phone using Twitter. And, you know, she would tell me, like, look, you got to keep it. You have to keep it just basic, because if you say anything or if you entice anything or do anything like that, it might lead her to say something to like my dad or something like that. Because
how would she get in touch with him?
Because apparently when I was in Cornerstone, my dad told her, because he had like hacked my computer or something like that, and then he found everything.
He's an electronics guy like you and your brother?
Except he's more of that like hacking level, like able to do all that stuff. So he had found, you know, like just the stuff that was related to her. And then, you know, he erased my whole entire computer. He put a password on it. So it's like, even when I came back up until Thursday, like I wasn't able to go onto my own computer to look at anything.
Basically, he's treating you like a small child.
Right. And rightfully so. I mean, spending that amount of money, I was acting childish. I can kind of get it.
He said on Thursday, his dad had found out that he was speaking to Sylvie again.
So he had apparently found out, and then
happy.
Right. And one of the stipulations was that he told me at the dinner was, if you speak to this woman again, you're out of the house. I'm kicking you out. You can pack up your shit and then you're off my property. And then because of the way that he used to be, he had told me that basically if that happens, that if I ever step back onto his property, that he would kill me.
When asked if he owned any guns, Grant said no, that he had gotten rid of all of them a while ago. At one point, near hour three, investigators ask Grant to tell them the truth, to tell them what they're missing. Grant admitted that he had lied about what time he had actually left that night and said it was later than what he had originally said. They then slid the crime scene photos over to him.
Did you leave the house with your brother Cody looking like that? Or did you leave the house with your father looking like that? Or your mother? Is that how you left your family?
No.
Grant said he didn't do anything.
Nobody else went into that house.
Who left your family like this? If you were the one that's been depressed, you were the one that owes money, you were the one that got into a confrontation with your father, who did this to your family? If you were trying to defend yourself or something else happened, we need to know now to help you. So tell us what happened, Grant. We're here to listen to you.
Grant, we need the truth. We're here to make this right.
You got to tell the truth. It's on the tip of your tongue, my man. I get that.
Did your father go after you and you try to protect yourself?
No, I didn't do any of this.
Later, Grant's older brother, Jason, came in to see him.
All right, so I take it you know what happened. I'm going to ask you plain out. You are not part of it anyway.
No.
Grant tells his brother how their dad kicked him out that night.
So he forced you? He basically told you you had to leave?
Yeah.
Okay. So who could have done this?
I don't know.
So you didn't have any problems or troubles with this woman or the online? You didn't owe him any money?
No.
I mean, there's no like loan shark out looking for you or...
No.
I don't see how things aren't adding up. I'm really confused, Grant.
It scares me that you want to leave here and not face up to what happened, Jason tells him. He begs for Grant to tell him the truth.
I'm sorry. I don't believe you. And I probably will have resentment for the rest of my life, whether you did it or you didn't do it. But I need closure. I need to know what happened to my mother, my father, and my brother, Cody.
Jason tells him that he's scared for Grant and scared for himself, and that he doesn't feel comfortable with Grant being around him alone. I understand, Grant says. Grant was allowed to leave after that interview, but investigators ended up putting him up in a hotel so they could keep an eye on him. And a few days later, on January 28th, he was arrested. My morning routine, when I get to have one if my daughter sleeps later than me, is super important in setting the tone for my entire day. I like to wake up, have my cup of coffee, read my emails, and just get ready for the day. But I'm someone who gets annoying headaches from being dehydrated, and so I've been trying to kick my coffee habit for months now. But it's hard, because I don't want to be sluggish, especially when I feel like I'm on the go all the time. Staying hydrated can help. And now there's Hydrant, which are these flavored electrolyte packets that are delicious and refreshing. You mix them directly into your water to efficiently and effectively hydrate your body. Each rapid hydration mix has the four essential electrolytes your body needs: sodium, potassium, magnesium, and zinc. This precise blend of electrolytes found in their mix helps your body hydrate quickly and stay hydrated all day. And Hydrant is backed by research. The formula was developed by an Oxford scientist to provide perfectly balanced, efficient hydration. There's no synthetic colors, stevia, or artificial sweeteners. The formula is vegan, and you can choose between three different flavors or a variety pack. Hydrant starts at just $1 a packet for a 30-day supply. Bonus, you can save even more with a monthly subscription. And for 25% off your first order, go to drinkhydrant.com/court or enter the promo code court at checkout. That's drinkhydrant.com/court and enter promo code court for 25% off your first order. That's drinkhydrant.com/court. Do you find that when you wash your hands too often, they tend to dry out? And the hand soaps you use seem to be a little monotonous? I know I do. Until I started using Caldrea, that is. Caldrea is a consciously crafted home and body care brand that combines thoughtful ingredients with delectable scents, making caring for ourselves and our homes a better experience. Their line of hand care products includes both hand soaps and moisturizing lotions that are incredibly effective, thoughtfully formulated, and smell divine. They're available in indulgent scents like ginger pomelo and basil blue sage. I already talked about ginger pomelo, so basil blue sage smells of basil, sage, rosemary, spearmint, and cinnamon leaf. It's awesome and leaves my hands smelling and feeling so clean and moisturized. Now, you can get free shipping on orders of $50 or more when you buy online at caldrea.com. That's caldrea.com. Visit caldrea.com and add wonder to your washing. Grant's trial started just 6 months after his arrest, in July 2019. If convicted, he would be facing the death penalty. Prosecutor Stuart Stone kicked off their case by showing the jury a photo of the Amato home, a big gray and white home located on Sultan Circle in Chuliota, Florida. "There are over 20 windows in the house," he said, before pointing out that none were broken, had pry marks, or showed any signs of forced entry. "There are 5 doors to that house," he said, "and none had any broken locks, broken door frames, or any signs of a forced entry." He said that inside the house were several televisions, expensive gaming systems, valuable computers, safes, and jewelry, that nothing was taken. It wasn't a home invasion, burglary, or robbery. He told the jury that Margaret was shot first, as she sat at her computer desk. The last activity on her computer was recorded at 4:44 p.m. on Thursday, January 24th, the day before her body was found. He said Chad, Grant's dad, was second to die. He was shot from behind as he was standing in the kitchen shortly after he got home from work, which he had left at 4:30. He said Chad fell down and then crawled around the kitchen counter, where he was then shot a second time. Cody was killed last. He left work around 9:15 that night. He arrived home, parked his car, and then entered the house through the garage. As soon as he crossed the threshold, he too was shot. Prosecutor Stone said that after Grant killed them, he staged a murder-suicide scene. He placed a handgun near Cody's body and shell casings in the vicinity of each body to correspond to the number of wounds. He said on some other occasion, Grant fired 4 shots from Cody's gun, collected those shell casings, and then placed them throughout the house. He then placed a holster with a gun on Chad's right hip under his belt to make it appear as though there was a confrontation between Chad and Cody, father and son. He then moved both Chad's and Cody's bodies.
Grant Amato was in that house with the dead bodies of his mother, father, and brother for at least 2.5 hours. You're going to see evidence that puts him in the house probably longer. But for at least 2.5 hours, he was in that house with those 3 dead bodies.
He said Grant transferred the contents of his computer onto a flash drive that was later found inside a pair of pants that were in his car. Grant also accessed his dad's phone and banking app.
He was home alone with his mother all day when the last human activity occurs on a computer. He was home when his father, Chad, arrives home from work. And he was home when his brother, Cody, arrives home from work, all by his own admission.
Prosecutor Stone said that Grant was obsessed with Sylvie and that he would lie to her and tell her that he was a professional gamer, that he owned his own home and drove a BMW. When his parents found out about her, they called her and told her who Grant really was, which ended the relationship.
Sylvie now knew that Grant Amato was not a professional gamer, did not own his own house, did not drive a BMW. And to Grant Amato, that was the end of the world. It was nothing to live for. And he was furious with his family for ending his world, his life as he believed it to exist.
Just 2 days before the murders, Grant typed an 8-page letter on his computer to 6 other men who were part of a virtual room he frequented, who also interacted with Sylvie. In the letter, he details his obsession with her, the lies he told, and his contempt for his family for telling on him, and how life as he knows it is over.
That's what this case is about. It's about his blind obsession with this woman, the end of the world, as he believed it to be because of his family, and his absolute contempt for those that he held responsible.
Grant's attorney, Jared Shapiro, countered by saying, if not Grant Amato, then who did this? He said that statement is not legally sufficient to convict Grant of murder. In fact, he said there are three facts that prove that Grant is not guilty. There's no physical evidence linking him to the deaths, no firearm that Grant had access to, and when police entered the home, they found a nefarious combination of drugs, guns, and ammunition. He said the family's DNA was not recovered on anything from Grant, including his clothing and shoes. And Grant's DNA is not on anything belonging to his family. He said the shell casings from the fired bullets were also tested for Grant's DNA. Nothing. He noted that Grant had sold his firearms a while ago, so he could use the money to remain in contact with Sylvie. There were still guns in the home, he said, but one was Cody's 9mm pistol, which he carried on him, and the others were locked up in Chad's bedroom, and he didn't have access to those. Further, he argued that the state's timeline was not accurate, that Chad had accessed his phone later that night, and that a neighbor recalled hearing gunshots on the morning of January 25th. He also noted that when police entered the home with a pocket knife, they also didn't leave any pry marks. Furthermore, he said Grant had no motive, that there was no friction between Grant and his mom, and that Grant and Cody were inseparably close. Cody even took care of Grant financially and paid for his entire portion of the Japan trip just a month prior. Whenever Grant needed monetary support, he received it from his family, Shapiro said. He had no motive whatsoever to kill them. Chris Sisko, Cody's friend and coworker, who had called police on the morning of the 25th to do a wellness check, testified that Cody left work at about 9:15 p.m. on January 24th. He said this was about 15 minutes earlier than normal, which he found strange.
That might not sound unusual to somebody who doesn't have our position, but when you're making double time and you leave 15 minutes early, that's quite a bit of money that you're just leaving on the table for no reason. He wasn't told to leave early. And, you know, we all have jobs. We like to make money. So I just thought it was weird. I'd never seen Cody leave early and leaving money on the table like that, just to dip out early.
He was asked to identify a photo of Cody. He confirmed that in the photo, Cody was wearing exactly what he last saw him wear as he left work that day, his hospital scrubs. Grant cried at the defense table as the photo was shown to the jury. Christine Snyder, a crime scene analyst with the Seminole County Sheriff's Office, testified that Chad's and Cody's bodies had been moved. Chad's autopsy revealed that he had been shot in the back of his head, so he should have been face down when they found him. However, he was face up, indicating to her that he had been flipped over. She also said the positioning of the holster and firearm on Chad's hip was unusual, that it had actually been put on backwards.
So normally, if you're carrying a firearm, you would probably put it inside of your pants for stability, especially a large gun like this, and he's a smaller individual. And you would have the grip towards the side, so then you can grab it quickly and pull it out. If you were carrying it the way that he has it, and you're right-handed, you would have to pull it out awkwardly, point it at yourself, and then point it towards somebody to fire it, which just doesn't make any sense. If you were right-handed and you were doing a cross draw, you would carry it on the other side and pull it out this way. But the only way that this is strange for a right-handed person to carry it this way.
She said the holster itself was clean, with no visible blood. However, there was an area of suspected blood on Chad's pants that was covered by the holster.
Due to the amount of blood on his pants and observing the movement in the blood, he was crawling around, face down, crawling through the blood in the kitchen. You would expect to see the suspected blood on the holster, not on the pants underneath the holster.
She also said Chad's right index finger looked significantly cleaner with less blood on it than his other fingers. As for Cody, she said the location of blood found under his body was unusual.
There was the significant amount of blood under his feet, almost a trail between his feet area and his head, a smaller pool of blood under his head where the injuries were. There was some blood on his hand, on the palm, which was not in contact with his head, where it was bleeding. And like we said before, blood pooling will go with gravity, so it's just going to drain down. It's not going to jump onto the hand from the injury. So it appeared that his head had been located where the larger pool of blood was at some point and then had been moved.
She said they conducted tests for footwear impressions at the scene, but that no shoe prints were found. Jason Amato, Grant's older brother, took the stand and testified about the Amato family. He said Margaret was his mom, and Chad wasn't his biological father, but that Chad had adopted him when he was 3 or 4. He said he moved out of the family home when he went to college in 2001, and that he now works as a mortgage loan underwriter in Winter Springs, Florida. Prosecutor Stone asked if Grant was proficient with computers, and Jason said yes. Both of his brothers and father were extremely proficient and even knew how to build a computer from scratch. After his family was murdered, investigators held onto the house for about a week. Jason was able to access it about a week later. Investigators advised him to go into the house and do an inventory check. Nothing appeared to be missing. But he did find a contract in his father's bedroom office. It was a contract his father had made with Grant, and it was stuffed into a legal pad.
I guess I would call it like an ultimatum. Some options that were given to Grant to choose between after leaving the facility. And based off of some of his choices, there were specific rules and regulations that my father had laid out for him. All right, so the first thing that was covered was living arrangements. You know, does he want to live at home, move out on his own, go to the military? It looks like Grant chose to live at home. He understood that the family would not cover or pay any current remaining future debts, etc. Goes on to say that, some rules are no post-midnight internet use, no more all-nighters online, limited TV. It says that he terminated his current phone and set him up with a new phone that I guess didn't have data or the ability to go on the internet. Some responsibilities where he had to get a job. He had some debts that he had to take care of. No savings. He owed the family some money. Owed the family an apology. It's very detailed.
Jason was asked if there was any reference to Sylvie in the contract.
It states that it informed Grant that they had reached out to this woman to let them know, or to let her know, some of the things that Grant had been saying weren't 100% true, and that he wasn't allowed to communicate with her anymore based off of those lies.
Jason told the court that in mid-December, after Cody and Grant had returned from their trip to Japan, the family staged an intervention with Grant. Grant then left the home and went to stay at his aunt's house. A few days later, at 3 a.m. on December 23rd, Jason said that he, Cody, and his parents went to that aunt's house to confront Grant. Cody called his aunt, and Grant came outside.
Really, Cody was talking to Grant about that he needed help with his obsession or his relationship with that woman. And initially the conversation didn't go well. My brother and Cody and my dad started getting on Grant. I stepped in and told him he just needed to get help and focus on himself. My brother and brother Cody and my dad calmed down. Cody or Grant got in the car. The three drove him to Fort Lauderdale, where he checked himself in that morning when they got there.
He was asked how heated that confrontation got.
Oh, it wasn't yelling. Really, I think what set it off was Cody was upset that Grant, I guess, wasn't being forthcoming. I guess he gave him a look. That's what Cody kept saying. Don't give me that look, or why are you giving me that look? And then my dad did put his hand on Grant's shoulder, not like punch him or hit him. He put his hand on his shoulder, and that's when I stepped in and told them to leave him alone, and I told Grant just to focus on himself. I think I gave him a hug. He really didn't say anything. I stepped back out since I wasn't really the one involved with the facility and taking him there. And I would say shortly after that, a couple minutes, he just walked to the car himself.
Jason was then asked about what he was doing on January 24th when prosecutors say his family was killed. He told the jury that he worked all day and got home around 6 p.m. He and his longtime girlfriend, Christina, then took her two daughters out to dinner. They went to a restaurant about 15 minutes away from their house, ate dinner, and then left around 9 or 9:30. When they got home, he said he stayed up with the oldest daughter, working on her homework, and then he went to bed. The next morning, he got up, dropped off the daughter at school, and went to work. He got a call around 9:30 from police officers who said that Cody hadn't shown up to work. Then the police showed up to his work around 12:30.
It was pretty scary. So they, you know, came into the building and the whole building got shut down and there were police officers everywhere. They took me into a room and, you know, questioned me and later gave me very general details that there was a woman and two males in their 30s found in the house. So I just tried to answer. No, I'm good. I'm good. So I just tried to answer their questions as best as possible. And they questioned me for, well, I mean, I was with them all day, but they initially questioned me for a couple hours. And then they went and searched my car in the parking lot for a couple hours. And then they went and searched my house for a couple hours.
Investigators initially thought that Chad's body was Grant, and that it was Margaret, Cody, and Grant who were deceased inside the house. On cross-examination, Jason said he's 4.5 years older than Cody and 6 years older than Grant. When they were younger, he said his father didn't allow a lot of friends over, and so it was just him and his brothers who played a lot. He agreed that Grant and Cody were very close and shared a lot of interests, including gaming and computers. He said he called his mom about once a week or so to check in on the family. After Grant was released from rehab, he said she sounded better than she had in the previous months. She told him that Grant was being more part of the family and had a job interview. She was excited that things seemed to be turning around. After each witness, the jury was allowed to ask the witness questions after being approved by both sides. Jason was asked if his father was ever abusive, either physically or otherwise. Jason said no. They got spanked when they were younger, but he said he doesn't consider that abuse. The jury also wanted to know why Grant didn't finish the program at the rehab facility. Jason said his mom told him that the person who oversaw the facility said that Grant was getting better, and they didn't feel that he needed to be there anymore. Jason's girlfriend, Christina, was called to the stand to corroborate Jason's testimony, mainly his alibi. She said she and Jason had been together for 11 years and that she called Margaret and Chad mom and dad. She confirmed that her family went to dinner on the night of January 24th. A receipt of that dinner was then shown to the jury. One of the jury questions for Christina was whether the total on the receipt was accurate. She said yes. She and Jason had split a ribs entree and an appetizer, and her two daughters ate. She was also asked about Jason's relationship with his father.
I would describe it as he was closer with his mother. I wouldn't say they were as close as he was with his mom, but he talked to his dad, and there was no, animosity or, I guess, bad blood that I was aware of between them. In fact, they spoke. We were out to dinner before this happened, and Chad called Jason to ask his advice about something, and Jason stepped out to talk to him. So to my understanding, you know, there was a father-son relationship. I was aware that he was his, not his biological father, but the only father he ever knew.
Eric Brothers, a crime scene technician, testified that he searched Jason's home, vehicle, and Jason himself. He found no blood, no weapons, and nothing that was suspicious.
So during the course of your entire search of Jason Amato, did you locate any blood?
No.
Any weapons?
No.
As for Grant, he said he saw a small abrasion on his left forearm that did not appear to be fresh. He didn't find any suspected blood on Grant's clothing or in his vehicle. However, he did find a note in Grant's vehicle. The note read, quote, "Brother, they just told me what happened. Dad told you to pack your shit and get out of his house because you were caught texting that woman again. Grant, I'll take care of all of your problems. I just need you back. I can't live without you, brother. I said I'd take care of all of your problems at the house, and I have. No one will bother you again regarding this. Just please come home. I can't do this again. If you think I'm part of the problem here, then I've really lost you, and I can't take that loss after everything. There is nothing I can say to change your mind on this. I love you, and I wish you felt the same. I was going to come after you again, but what's the point?" Grant's jeans were in his car, along with a USB thumb drive found inside. The jury had questions for Eric Brothers, too. They asked if it was confirmed that Cody wrote that note, and he said he didn't know. He was also asked how much blood is needed to show up in their testing. He said Blue Star, which is what they used, is designed to look for very small amounts of blood, and they didn't find any. He was asked if any gunshot residue tests were done on Grant's car, and he said he doesn't know. Deputy Daniel Anderson, a deputy sheriff with the Seminole County Sheriff's Office, testified that Grant told him that he had written that note found in his car. Grant told him that he had had a meeting with Cody before he left, and then had memorialized their conversation in that letter. When Deputy Anderson asked why it was written as if Cody had written it, Grant said that he had just been trying to memorialize the conversation. Deputy Anderson also testified about Grant's interrogation.
Did he ever ask you or Investigator Moteri why you were talking with him, why you wanted to talk with him, or how his family was?
He never asked any of those questions.
Arthur Rubart, a crime scene analyst, responded to the hotel Grant was staying in when he was arrested. In addition to credit cards with Chad's and Cody's name on them, there was another note. This one was located inside of a notepad and was dated January 25th, 2019. The note read, quote, "I miss being at home already, and it's only been one day since I was kicked out by Dad. Cody said he'd take care of it, but there's nothing he can do about this. I miss the house and comfort, but the atmosphere had been getting worse and worse. Cody sounded pretty sad, and I told him that it's over at the house. We had a good 29 years, and I wish it could work out. Looks like I finally have to live on my own. Sadly, Cody is still helping me by giving me his debit card until I can get settled. Oh, and the interview went well today. Oh, and no phone service because Dad canceled it. tough days. Janelle Kennedy was a security supervisor in the CVS Health building where Chad worked. She said his badge was swiped for the last time on January 24th, 2019 at 4:32 p.m. when he left the building. One of the jury's questions was whether firearms are allowed on the premises or in employees' vehicles, and she said no, but she added that they don't do a search of cars. A majority of the state's case was in the form of phone records, namely the records for Chad and Cody's cell phones. Crime scene analyst Rubart testified that around 9:16 p.m. on the night of January 24th, there were four calls made to and from Cody's cell phone. The first was from Chad's cell phone, but only lasted for 1 second. The second was from the Amato house phone, and that lasted for 115 seconds. The third was again from Chad's cell phone for 4 seconds, and the fourth was from Cody's phone to the house phone, which lasted for 23 minutes. He said Cody's phone stopped talking to any cell towers at 2:05 a.m. Geraldine Bly, a digital forensic examiner, took the stand for hours and testified about additional cell phone and computer activity in the case. Bly's testimony helped create a digital forensic timeline. She started off with Grant's computer. She said a thumb drive was connected to Grant's computer at 11:32 p.m. on January 24th. It was disconnected at 12:27 a.m. That thumb drive was later found in the pocket of Grant's pants that were found inside of his car. There were more than 2,500 files on that thumb drive, including 647 photographs of Sylvie, some explicit and some not. There were also explicit videos of her. At 11:39 p.m., Cody's iPhone was then connected to Grant's computer. The process was not completed, however, because no passcode was entered. At 11:42 p.m., the phone was connected to the computer in recovery mode, which Bly said is a way for an iPhone to connect to iTunes without having to boot it up. She said you can either then restore the phone or update the operating system. She testified that restoring the phone is like wiping it.
Based on everything else that I examined, I believe the person was trying to wipe the phone.
As for Margaret's computer, she said the last activity was at 4:44 p.m.
So, Investigator Bly, is it fair to say that from 4:44 on January 24th, 2019, no human being did anything to that laptop?
Yes, that's correct.
Does that include turning it off?
Yes, it does.
Bly then testified about Chad's iPhone. In the afternoon, there were visits on his phone to the Gator Chatter football forum. Then, at 4:41 p.m., he was listening to something on the iHeartRadio app while driving home from work. At 5:24 p.m., the phone was unplugged from his car, and at 5:25, the phone's health app shows that he took 67 steps, presumably walking into his home.
Is there any activity on this phone whatsoever reflected on the database files from 5:25 until 5:52?
No, there's not.
Nothing?
Nothing.
The phone's dead?
Nothing on the knowledge database or on the databases that indicate user activity.
The phone was unlocked at 5:52 p.m. At 5:53 p.m., the Preferences app was opened and settings were changed so the phone would remain unlocked. From this point on, the phone remained unlocked until after midnight. At 6:01 p.m., multiple notes were accessed from the Notes app. Every note in Chad's iPhone was accessed and reviewed at that time. Bly said she looked into the phone's history and had not noticed that practice before. At 6:14 p.m., the Safari app was opened and several internet searches were conducted, including for how to wipe an iPhone without a passcode and if you forgot a passcode. At 6:46 p.m., a message was sent from Chad's phone to Cody's phone. Cody's phone responded at 6:47. At 8:27 p.m., the Ring application, a security app for video doorbells and security cameras, was deleted from the phone. At 9.07 p.m., the Messages app was opened. Nothing was sent or received. Someone was apparently just looking through the messages. At 9.11 p.m., Chad's phone received two incoming phone calls from Cody. Both calls had been deleted from the call log. At 11.28 p.m., the Safari app was accessed and internet searches were made, along with a visit to the Apple website. Then, the phone's health app indicated that the phone went up one flight of stairs. And at 12.08 a.m., the USAA bank app was accessed. Bly said someone used the biometric fingerprint to access it.
You testified previously about the iPhone 8 being able to be unlocked via fingerprint and by passcode. Based on your training and experience, field study, etc., are you aware whether an iPhones have been successfully unlocked with a deceased person's finger?
Yes, you can.
The phone was locked and then unlocked again at 12:31 a.m. when the Blink app was deleted from the phone. Bly testified that the Blink app allows you to monitor security cameras in or around your house. Chad's phone then remained unlocked until 3:16 p.m. Bly also testified about Grant's Microsoft Pro. She said the web history shows that at 2:54 a.m., Grant was on Wi-Fi and accessed Gmail. At 3:06 a.m., he made a payment in the amount of $599.99 to restore his account on myfreecams.com. According to both prosecutors and Grant, this is when he was in the public's parking lot using their Wi-Fi. On cross-examination, Grant's attorney, Jared Shapiro, questioned Bly about Cody's phone having been plugged into Grant's computer. Remember, earlier in her testimony, Bly had testified that it appeared as though someone had tried wiping Cody's phone.
So you were not present in the Amato residence on the night of January 24th, 2019, is that correct?
That is correct. I was not present.
You have no idea when Cody Amato passed away, is that correct?
That is correct.
And you were not in the Amato home when the iPhone was plugged into Grant Amato's tower, that's correct?
I was not, yes, that is correct.
You have no idea who plugged that phone into Grant's tower, correct?
Correct.
Shapiro also pointed out that Chad had conducted searches on his iPhone about a week prior to his death about how to reset passwords on laptops. When it was time for the jury to ask questions, they first asked if it was ever determined which finger Chad used to unlock his iPhone or his banking app. Bly said no, she was unable to determine that. When asked if the Blink app stores any recorded video, she said there was no video. Could she tell when calls on Chad's phone were deleted? She said no. And lastly, was Chad's phone connected to Grant's computer? She said no, she wasn't able to determine that. Only Cody's iPhone was. Jericho Fine used to be friends with Grant and Cody Amato. He testified that at one point, he considered them his brothers. In December 2018, about a month before the murders, he went to Japan with Cody and Grant. He was asked if Grant wore gloves on the trip, and he said yes, black leather ones. He was also asked if he noticed anything about Grant's demeanor during the trip. He said he did notice that the energy wasn't as high as he had thought it would be.
I know a few days before we were to come back, we were to go to a museum, like for an animation studio that we all love. And it was like, it's like, you know, like a once in a lifetime thing. And he didn't want to go. I was told he got food poisoning, but we had been eating at the same places. So I thought it was weird, but he didn't want to go to something that we'd been planning to go to for a while. And then he just stayed up in the room.
Prosecutor Stone asked him about an instance where Grant went missing while on their trip.
Cody got into the shower. Grant told me that he was going to go down to the lobby and like find something to eat. So I didn't think anything of it. And Cody got out of the shower and asked me where Grant was. And I said he went down to the lobby to get something to eat. And Cody immediately checked the closet for his duffel bag and then said, where's Grant's duffel bag? And I was like, I don't know. I didn't notice him take anything. And so Cody left me at the hotel for more than 2 hours. I was just kind of sitting in the lobby while he went to find Grant, and he was messaging me on WhatsApp, trying to keep me posted. And he found him at like a pachinko, like a gambling type building. And I guess he was on his tablet using the Wi-Fi.
Jericho said Cody seemed to be keeping Grant on a short leash. If Grant would wander off, Cody would say, Grant, here now, which was a little awkward. He said there was some tension. When asked if he gave anyone permission to use his credit card during the trip, he said no. He said he noticed after the trip that the card had been used without his permission.
I was out to dinner, and I went to pay for the dinner with the Discover card, and it had been frozen. So I contacted my father, since it's like a family account, and he sent me a screenshot of like three charges on the Discover. One went through, and then the other two were denied, but they were for MyFree CAM tokens.
He told the jury that in April 2012, he had purchased a gun that had been used in his favorite anime. 3 years later, he sold it to his friend Blake Turpin. Blake Turpin was also friends with Grant and Cody. 2 weeks prior to the murders, Blake said he had a get-together at his house. It was him, Grant, Cody, and Jericho. They went to dinner and then went back to his place to play video games and watch TV. Blake identified a gun in court, the one he purchased from Jericho, a 9mm. He said he used to keep it in his bedroom closet on a shelf. He kept ammunition there as well. He was asked if Grant knew about that gun, and he said yes. Grant was there when Jericho first purchased it, and when he purchased it from Jericho. He said Grant has also used it when they had gone shooting on a few occasions. At one point that night, Grant said he had to go to the bathroom, which was past Blake's room. Blake said he always keeps that closet door open, so the gun was likely visible. He said he has a roommate, but that roommate never really went into his room. After the murders, in June, about 6 months later, Blake was doing some spring cleaning and went through his closet.
I went into the closet and was getting rid of some older stuff. And when I picked up the gun boxes, I noticed that one was significantly lighter than it should be. I opened it up and noticed the firearm and one of the two magazines it came with were missing.
He said he also noticed about 6 bullets missing, but nothing else missing from his house. He reported it the next day to the sheriff's office. He had a feeling it may have been used in this case. He was asked if he had ever seen Chad carrying a gun on his hip before. He said no, he never saw him carry a gun. Richard Ruth, a crime lab analyst with the FDLE, testified that Blake's gun that was stolen has what's called polygonal rifling, and that the projectiles that were used in the murder also have polygonal markings. That gun has never been recovered, however, so he couldn't confirm that it was the murder weapon. Ruth also told the court that the bullets found near the bodies were not from the gun that killed them. There were 3 additional guns found in the home, and Ruth examined all of them. He said none of them were the murder weapon. A DNA expert then testified about a pair of black leather gloves that were found in Grant's hotel room. The inside had Grant's DNA, but he could not make a conclusive determination as to whether Cody, Chad's, or Margaret's DNA was there too. Jennifer Sawyer, one of the Amato's neighbors, testified that she heard gunshots on the night of the 24th.
It was between 8:30 and 9:30 at night.
Now tell the jury what you heard.
I heard gunshots, and I heard them one right after another. And I know that it was less than 5 shots fired, because at the time I made a mental note that that was strange to hear gunfire at that time of night. I mean, it had been dark then for hours.
Dr. Tara Jones, the medical examiner who conducted the autopsies, said that based on her evaluation, it was unlikely that Cody committed suicide. The autopsies show that all three victims were shot and not at close range. All three deaths were homicides, she said. Grant sobbed at the defense table with his head in his hands as photos of his family were shown to the jury. Dr. Jones said she could not determine a time of death for any of the victims. The state's last witness was Allison Leneve, a forensic scientist and expert in gunshot residue. She testified that Grant's leather gloves tested positive for gunshot residue on both the right and left hand. But on cross, she said it doesn't mean that someone definitely fired a weapon.
Now, a positive gunshot residue test doesn't mean that someone actually fired a firearm, correct?
That's correct, sir.
A positive gunshot residue test doesn't mean the person tested likely fired a gun either, correct?
That's correct. All it means is it's a possibility.
You stole my next question. So you would confirm the most you could possibly draw from a positive gunshot residue test is that they possibly fired, maybe, a firearm, correct?
They either discharged a firearm or in proximity or near someone who discharged a firearm or touched something that had gunshot residue on it.
She said the residue could have been transferred there.
If somebody is a gun owner or owns firearms that have been discharged, it's possible that there would be residue on surfaces in which those guns are being held.
Right, because you said that residue can be deposited by coming into contact with a surface or object that has gunshot residue on it. So these surfaces would be very likely to be in someone's home that had firearms and had placed fired firearms on those surfaces, correct?
It would be more likely if a firearm was discharged over a particular surface. But if there is residue on a firearm that had been recently discharged and that was brought onto a surface or an area, it can transfer from that firearm to that area. So to answer your question, yes, it's possible.
Before we get into the defense case, a hearing took place outside of the jury's presence. In it, the defense wanted to introduce a text message from Margaret to her husband, Chad, on January 9th, 2019, just a few weeks before the murders. It was sent at 10:53 a.m. The text read, in part, "I have spent the last 30 years of my life, except for the few years we were separated, trying to meet your expectations. You have spent the last 15 trying to meet mine. We are different, but together I thought we had found peace and appreciation for each other's strengths that made us a solid team. 1 week ago, in the space of 3 hours, you vehemently told me how much you hate me and what a loser I am, that I am responsible for ruining your life, that I think of you as a meal ticket and fixer so I can sit back and do nothing, that you want to kill me, and most hurtful, that you regret not choosing someone else. I am to recover and not lose my job, keep Cody feeling good by not perpetuating a depressive atmosphere, and move Grant in a meaningful direction. I will support whatever you need to do for you. At this point, I don't care what that means for me. I'm tired of fighting. You can have everything." The judge ruled that that text would not be admissible. The defense's first witness was Sloane Young, Cody's girlfriend and former coworker. She said on January 24th, Cody left work around 9:15 p.m. after telling her that he was calling his dad.
Before he left, did he tell you he was calling his dad?
He did not specifically say he was calling his father. He said, from what I told the police originally, that he received a phone call, because that's what it appeared to look like from where I was sitting. However, phone records stated that that was incorrect. He looked at his phone, and he put his phone up to his ear, and I looked at him, and I said, "Who is that?" And he said, "My dad," and he walked away. So he made the call.
Okay, I understand that. Okay, so, but that's what he said that night, correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
On cross, she said she couldn't confirm whether or not he actually spoke with his dad, just that he had said he was calling him. She was asked if Cody had a blink camera in his room, where if someone walked in, it would alert him, and she said yes. The defense then called Nicholas Stewart to the stand, an agent who generated the report on Chad's cell phone. He said that on January 18th, 2019, at 11:50 p.m., Cody's phone texted Chad's phone saying, "Dad, for the third time now, delete the Blink app." Geraldine Bly was also recalled to the stand for the defense. She reiterated her testimony that the Blink app was deleted from Chad's phone on January 25th, 2019, at 12:31 a.m. Bly also reiterated her testimony that on January 25th at 12:08 a.m., Chad's banking app was accessed on his phone using a biometric fingerprint. Arthur Rubart, one of the crime scene analysts who also testified for the state, was then called for the defense. He testified that inside an armoire located in the Amato's master bathroom was a system that is used for growing marijuana. In another closet, one belonging to Chad, were three mason jars and a metal tin on top of a gun safe. Rubart said there was suspected marijuana with humidity scales in the mason jars, and the tin was a grinder, often used to grind up marijuana. At the bottom of the closet were multiple boxes with ammunition. He said he also found marijuana in a master bathroom drawer and in Margaret's vehicle. Rodney Funk, another neighbor of the Amatos, took the stand and said that on the morning of January 25th, he heard popping noises. Was it gunfire?
Now, when you were out on your driveway on the morning of January 25th, 2019, did you hear gunshots?
I don't know what I heard. No, I did not.
Did you hear a popping sound?
Yes, sir, I did.
Did you hear multiple popping sounds?
Three. One, then two after that.
Erica Johansson said she works at a specialty pharmacy. She interviewed Grant Amato on the morning of January 25th for a job he was applying for. She said the interview was scheduled for 10 a.m. and that Grant came early, around 9-ish. She said he was calm and she didn't notice anything abnormal about him. She said it was a completely normal interview. But on cross, she said he looked tired, his eyes were glassy and a little pink.
My first impression was that he looked a little, as I said earlier, creepy. I don't like saying that. I feel bad saying that, but yes.
Okay. And did you offer the job to Grant Amato on January 25th of 2019?
I did not offer it to him.
Samuel Coors, an owner of a pawn shop at Florida Pawn and Gun, was another witness for the defense. He said that in September 2018, his store purchased a rifle and a 9mm gun for about $600 from Grant Amato. The state's last witness was Jason Amato. Jared Shapiro had just one question for him.
Were you aware that there was marijuana going on at 2112 Sultan Circle?
No, sir.
Okay, no further questions.
In their closing arguments, the prosecution said that Grant not only killed his family, but that he made mistakes.
Grant Amato knew about blood. He knew about DNA. He knew how to shoot. But after you murder your family, you make mistakes. And I pointed out the mistakes he's made, including the firearm being on Chad backwards, including the digital evidence that we were able to locate, including the bank records, including all the cellular data, including the Wi-Fi records, deleted records, deleted applications, right?
It's a stressful situation being a murderer. You're bound to make mistakes.
The defense said the prosecution did not prove their case.
There's one verdict in this case, ladies and gentlemen, and that's not guilty. It did not meet their burden. Hold it to them. I'm sorry for what happened, but they did not prove Grant's case to the exclusion of a reasonable doubt.
But did the jury think the prosecution proved their case? After about 8 hours of deliberations, they announced their decision. Grant was guilty of first-degree murder. But instead of the death penalty, he was sentenced to life without parole. And that's all for this episode. As always, I'd love to know what you think about this case. Do you think Grant murdered his family because of his obsession with Sylvie? Or do you think the real killer might still be out there? How do you think the defense did in this case? You can let me know by joining our conversation on Instagram at Court Junkie, by tweeting me at Court Junkie Pod, or by emailing me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. If you'd like to hear these episodes without the ads and hear additional Court Junkie bonus episodes, head on over to courtjunkie.com/support, which will redirect you to my Patreon page. I just added a bonus episode about the Matthew Apperson trial. Apperson is the man who shot George Zimmerman after an argument. Again, that's at courtjunkie.com/support. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.
Podcast One presents. This is a collect call from Sing Sing.
My name is John J. Lennon. I'm locked up for selling drugs and committing murder. I'm also a contributor for Esquire magazine and the Marshall Project. So I'm a writer and I'm a prisoner. Imagine trying to stay focused and talk about issues of substance, with geeks slamming, prisoners screaming, and PAs blaring in the background.
Get new episodes every Wednesday on Spotify, Podcast One, and Apple Podcasts.